Welcome back to another episode of Recruitment Journeys with me, Pete Watson from Mint R2R, Australia's longest serving rec to rec. Unapologetic plug there, completely shameless. Recruitment Journeys is the original and longest running podcast dedicated to you, the Australian recruitment industry. And in this podcast, as ever, we chat to hand-selected recruitment identities about the highs and the lows of their particular recruitment journeys in the hope to educate, inspire, and motivate you, our listeners. Now, please remember, on the off chance that you've listened to one of these episodes and indeed enjoyed it, it would be massively appreciated if you could like, share, or subscribe, or ideally, all three. We don't ask for much at Recruitment Journeys, just a little bit of love. Massive thanks to our sponsors, A Positive Finance. Everything you need to start or scale your recruitment business. Right, that's enough of the intros. It's all taken care of. Let's get into the next episode of Recruitment Journeys. Jay O'Brien worked for Hays, a global recruitment company, for over 13 years. Then he decided to spin his career completely on its head and go and work for a privately owned specialist, Redpath Partners. Every element of his day-to-day work life would now be completely different. Or would it? We chat with Jay around his reasoning to immerse himself in a completely different working culture and environment, the pros and the cons, the key differences, and we ask him, candidly, if the move has paid off. This career pathway going from a global organization to a privately owned organization is not unique to Jay. Many have done it before, and many will do it in the future. So we were very grateful to Jay for talking us through his own personal experience in the hope that it can help others considering such a move in the future. Hope you enjoy this week's episode of Recruitment Journeys. Jay O'Brien from Redpath Partners. Good morning, mate. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Pete?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for coming on Recruitment Journeys.
Pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
We've just ascertained in the kind of pre-podcast chat that you are a complete podcast virgin.
I am.
You've never done a podcast, and I was mortally offended to discover you've never actually listened to any of my podcasts.
I was just being open and honest, and it's not for the want of it's just time. But I have seen him. I see the comments. So yeah, I was flattered to be invited into that company.
Well, it's interesting because you've agreed to do something without having the foggiest clue what's involved, which I like. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what I am going to do then. In that case, I'm going to let you know what this podcast is all about. We are 3 years in, fourth series in, but I started Recruitment Journeys with the hope to educate, inspire, motivate recruiters by handpicking selected identities from the recruitment, the Australian recruitment industry, have them tell their story, and in the hope that other recruiters would listen to that story and say, cool, I like it a little bit of what Jay O'Brien's saying. I'm going to, maybe try and follow that career path. So you're here to inspire, educate, and motivate, Jay. Right. No pressure.
I'll do my best.
No pressure whatsoever. Mate, I've already given the listeners a little bit of an introduction as to who you are, but in your own words, who is Jay O'Brien?
Okay, I am 42 years of age. I'm originally from the UK, as you can probably tell by my Cockney twang accent.
Are you actually a Cockney?
I'm not, no. There's very few people that are actual Cockneys. You have to be born by the Bow Bells, as legend has it, to be a bona fide Cockney. But I was born and brought up around Essex, and I lived there pretty much all my life until I moved out to Australia. Left school at 16, didn't know what I wanted to do to a degree. Started working in London, met my now wife when I was 18. And then we decided when we were 21 that we were up for a bit of an adventure. We had some friends in Australia, came over here, and that was 20 odd years ago.
Wow.
But I'm pretty basic, if I'm being honest. I like socializing. I love my family to bits. My happy place is being around my kids. I really enjoy what I do for a living. Love living in Australia. But yeah, keeping fit, looking after myself mentally, physically, and yeah, spending time doing things that are good for the soul.
Which wouldn't include following Manchester United,
Not at the moment, no.
as we both do. And hasn't, well, you say not at the moment, hasn't for the last decade.
I know. It's a sad fact. Yeah, I mean, growing up when I was a kid, my dad was a huge United supporter, as is my brother. So it's sort of running the family. And but yeah, I mean, just over the last sort of 10 years, it's unfortunately sort of fallen by the wayside. I mean, there's still obviously glimmers of hope there. But as it turns out, so my wife, I don't know if you know this, but my wife is the business manager for Sydney FC Football Club.
Did not know that.
And I've developed a real passion for Sydney FC. I mean, the A League is certainly not what the Premier League is, but just in terms of being able to watch live football, both male and female, obviously the recent World Cup was
Yeah,
amazing.
it's cool, isn't it?
My two girls, who are 10 and 7, both play football or soccer as it's known. So yeah, it's given me that sort of passion locally to still be involved and get behind a club, which is pretty cool.
Love it, love it. Let's not turn into this into a football podcast, but
Oh, sorry.
my 12-year-old, actually just turned 13, I nearly lost him to Liverpool a few years ago, and we had to sit
Right.
down and have some very serious conversations about loyalty and commitment.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, through the eyes of a 13-year-old, you can only take my word that Manchester United used to be the best football club in the world.
Of course.
Not anymore, not anymore.
No, sadly not.
Now, in classic live podcast viewing situations, I don't know if you can hear Jay, but I don't know who it is, but somebody started drilling something very loudly next door or above me or
Oh,
below me. I hope it
perfect.
doesn't spoil the listening pleasure. Now then, mate, right, so we're going to talk about your career, your recruitment journey. But
Yeah.
before we do that, we like to try and give the listeners a little bit of an insight into who the person is behind the professional veneer. And you are a
Yeah.
man with a professional veneer, Jay, it has to be said. You know, the rest of the industry is losing the professional veneer. You are
Yeah.
not. Kudos. Hey, what did you want to be growing up? Because it's blatantly obvious that not many people want to be a recruiter growing up. What did you have your hopes and dreams pegged on?
Well, this kind of plays into that comment. So when I was younger, I was adamant I was going to be involved in fashion.
Wow.
Loved drawing, loved designing outfits, and just I had a young age a passion for it. So that was kind of something that I just thought, when I'd go leave school, maybe that's something I'd pursue. And then towards the tail end, when I was about, I think I was about 13 or 14, I got a weekend job working in an antique shop, and I was blown away by antiques. I thought it was amazing. Totally immersed in it. Started doing some trade work with the French polishers and just some of the restoration work that goes into it. And just fascinated with the. I quite like history and learning about different. Different cultures and backgrounds, and it was just I was blown away with the stories around. It was predominantly furniture, but one-off things, and I just thought it was amazing. So that was something that I was really passionate about for about 2 years, and then I discovered nightclubs, and that weekend job went out the window.
Yeah.
So sadly, even though I look back on it with really fond memories, when I was leaving school, like. Most sort of circa 16-year-olds around that time, house music was massive. Loved nightclubs. So I got into promotions and I started to run my own club nights in London for a couple of years, pretty successfully in about four or five bars.
Yeah.
Whilst then I got a job in London, and yeah, and again that was probably the first real area I thought I could actually do something here. But I quickly realized that being a 17 or 18 cocky, thought he knew it all in that scene doesn't go down well with nightclub owners. So I realized that after a couple of events that didn't perhaps go as planned because I was naive, probably wasn't the right environment for someone of my age. Albeit I had a great time. It actually gave me the opportunity to buy a house because I was doing so
Okay.
well.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. But
That's incredible.
yeah, no, that like I look back now and yeah, that was amazing to be able to do that. A sort of 18-year-old. But then I fell into London. I started working in a quantity surveying firm, and then as I didn't even know what recruitment was, as most people. And then yeah, sort of fell into it that way. But to
Yeah.
answer your question, sorry, yeah, growing up it was fashion, potentially antiques, and then yeah, clubbing.
Mate, three answers that I wasn't expecting. I wasn't expecting any of those. And that would explain why I can't remember what LinkedIn post I put up last week when you sent me a text message saying that you owned four pairs of Patrick Cox wannabes.
I did. Yeah, I was a big fan of Patrick Cox, and at that time I had a decent head of hair. Not like, well, I have no hair now, but so yeah, Patrick Cox and hair gel was a regular purchase.
Yeah, absolutely. Mate, can you tell us something about Jay O'Brien? I mean, you've already told us a few things, but can you tell us something about Jay O'Brien that not many people know?
I think, I mean, not that I advertise it, but for the last 5 years, I've been a pretty staunch vegan. Followed a full plant-based diet. Probably a bit of a victim of the propaganda that really kicked off a fair few years ago. But I do, I train a lot. I've always been into nutrition and health and fitness. And just for me personally, I was doing a few ultra marathons at the time. And there's a lot of long distance runners that are plant-based. And I wanted to know how I could get faster, run longer distances. So tried it and yeah, never really looked back. And it's been amazing for
Isn't
me
that interesting?
personally. And yeah, and so that's probably one thing that not many people don't. And I don't drink alcohol as well. So again,
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many people know that. Not that, again, I advertise it, and that's a more of a recent thing, but
Yeah.
yeah, don't drink alcohol.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Nutrition is something that I think about a lot. Sadly, I don't really get past the point of thinking about it. Hence these jowls that are
Well,
on full
at least you're
display.
thinking about it.
Oh mate, I just it's I, and it annoys the hell out of me because I go to so I'm 50, right? I'm a bit older than you, but I go to the gym every day with reasonable discipline and I put
Yeah.
in the grind, but it's like everybody keeps telling me it's 80% what you put in your mouth and 20% what you do down the gym. So I
Yeah.
can see looking at you that you're a fit and healthy man. And I'm old, I'm a dad bod geezer
Healthy
over
feet. Look,
here.
I get it. It's not for everyone, and it's one of those things. It's your own journey is your own journey. Whatever works for you.
Yeah.
And look, it's not something that I publicize, or I'm not one of those ex-smoker types, or ex-meat eater types that when I'm out with a client, I can't believe you're doing it. I'm not that sort of person. What's right for you is right for you. But yeah, for me, it's been probably a bit of a game changer in terms of my outlook and just my general health, fitness, and mental health as well.
I love that. I love that. So, mate, take us back to the beginning of your recruitment career. You sort of started to touch on it, but how and why did you break into the wonderful world of
Yeah.
recruitment?
Again, I mean, I'm sure you'll agree. I mean, I'm still yet to meet anyone that has said, certainly who's been in it for more than 10 years, that they actively sought out a career in recruitment.
Me. You've just met one. You've just met
Yeah.
one. There you go.
Okay. Well, you're bucking the trend.
I am, mate, but I've told my story too many times. So back to you, mate.
Yeah, look, I didn't even know what recruitment was at the time. And I was working in, as I said, I was working for a quantity surveying firm in Euston, and really enjoying being in London. I was, I think, sort of 17, nearly 18 at the time. And then a friend of mine was working for a company, and I don't know any people from the UK who are circa my age will maybe remember a magazine called 9 to 5, which was like basically a free handout magazine. And it was, advertising jobs, stuff that's going on in town, kind of like a really poor version of a Time Out. But the company that my friend was working for, the guy who owned it, owned 9 to 5. And as a sideline, he had a recruitment business called Prime. And just got talking one day, and he was telling me what he does. And, at the time, I vividly remember him just saying, yeah, all I do is call people, find out what jobs they might need filling, and then I go and speak to a load of people, and then send, well, at the time it was fax, CVs across, and I get paid for it. And I sort of couldn't get my head around it at the time, and I said, so how does it work? What's the ratios? And when he sort of described to me that it's open-ended, you know, what you do in a day is essentially what you get paid to a degree, and how much you want to get paid is up to you. Like that was just sort of red rag to a bull in terms of, you know, the opportunity to really dictate my own financial earnings. So had an interview, totally lowballed me on the base salary, which I was a bit taken aback by, but again, I backed myself, took the job.
Can you remember what you got? What your starting salary was?
My starting salary, if I'm not mistaken, was £9,000 a year.
Yeah, my starting salary at the S3 group was £11,000.
Yeah,
incredible,
right.
Eh?
And I think at the time I was already on, I think I was on about 12 and a half, 13. And obviously at that age, that's a lot of money in terms of a difference.
Yeah.
But when obviously they described the commission structure, how that operated, which I can't remember. And there was other people, you know, only a couple of years older than me making, you know, a lot more money than I was making in my prior job. I just thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it.
What sort of recruitment was it?
It was that they did a lot of banking, predominantly investment banks, not so much retail, but the investment banks. And I started doing finance predominantly for banking, the sector. Which at the time, and again, it was Yellow Pages time, there was something like four times the amount of pages in the Yellow Pages than there were to banks. So that's how competitive it was at the time. And, you know, in true old school style, like this is how old it was. There was people that were still smoking at their desks. It was insane. And I was given a box of cards that just had, you know, really poor handwritten notes of previous conversations, numbers, and it was just right, just go for it, you know, no computer, you know, just start making calls, find out what openings they've got, take a brief, don't worry about meeting them, get their fax number, and then we'll send them CVs. And I loved it. It was absolutely amazing.
It was so crude back then, wasn't it? It was so basic.
It was just, you know, I liked the fact that I had one job to do, and that was phone as many people as I could. And look, I look back now, and in terms of, you know, I mean, in terms of training, I think all it was half an hour of, right, here's a bit of Dutch courage, like get on the phone and let's see how you go. But just listening to, you know, the people around me that have been doing it for a while, the buzz in the room, you know, the fees that people were writing up on a, you know, on a chalkboard at the time. It was a buzz. It was awesome. I loved it. I wanted to be there, you know, constantly. And yeah, at times, you know, the start of it, like everyone goes through, it was a bit demoralizing. You know, I got told to F off several times. I got told that I wasn't good at what I was doing, and, you know, as everyone, you know, does. But I don't know. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people who have been in recruitment, certainly in the UK market in the 90s or, you know, early 2000s, will hopefully agree that, you know, I would never train someone like that myself now, you know, and it horrifies me to think that that's something that people have gone through, but I wouldn't change it because it's made me as resilient and just as thick skinned in a good way. But I can also see why that doesn't work now. But all of that has, I think, set me up for, you know, my career to date. But I loved it. It was awesome. It was great. And I just love being in London.
How long were you with Prime?
I was there until I came to Australia. So about 2.5, 3 years, something like that. And we had we were at Oxford Circus. We had an office above the station. And then we moved to Liverpool Street. And again, as you'd imagine, it was just the buzz. I loved it. It was, you know, it was brilliant. I thought it was the best job in the world.
And then you went to Hayes. Is that right?
I did. I'm not in London. So when when me and my wife my girlfriend at the time, decided to come out here, I wanted to stay in recruitment. At the time, the visa that I was on was only a 1 year, and you could only work for a company for up to 3 months until you got sponsored.
Yeah.
So I initially joined a one-person operation, and it was music recruitment. It was like production staff and back office staff. Again, you know, sort of playing to my passion for music. I thought, oh, okay, this could be cool. But unfortunately, even though it was good and I was doing well, you know, even though it was a short term, the company just weren't set up for sponsorship. So I knew it was only going to be for a very short time. And then when I started to explore the market, there was probably an element of me that, whilst I'd never worked, the prime in the UK were a boutique. You know, there was like, I think, 20 of us tops. And I just thought it was probably safe to join a bigger company where there's, you know, progression, proper training, and obviously, you know, totally selfishly at the time, the opportunity to get sponsorship. So I think I had 6 or 7 interviews with majors. Thankfully, got offered, you know, a good few of them. But I just liked Hayes. I liked the people I met at the time. You know, the brand was obviously a huge brand. There was a lot of expats there. I think, you know, looking back as well, I could see that there was probably an opportunity to make friends as well, you know, and integrate. I didn't know I was obviously going to be here for the long term then, but, you know, whether it was five-a-side football or, you know, just meet a few people you can go out with on the weekend, it just felt right.
Sorry to interrupt. So you purposefully targeted all of the big boys. Okay. So you're talking to the Pages and the Randstads and the Walters and the Halves of this world.
As I said, I think because at the time, my wife, Stace, she could only obviously do, you know, she was at the time more admin based. So it probably wasn't an opportunity for her, as we could see, to get any sort of longer term visa. So I could see the only way was probably going to be through me getting a job, but ideally with one of the bigger players. And it worked, thankfully.
Absolutely worked. I mean, you were there for 13 and a half years.
Yeah, it was a long time. I always remember this. So when I went for the interview, and I still remember it to this day, I sat in a boardroom and I met an individual who was the original director at the time. Really nice guy. We had a good chat. And I walked in and I looked very London. I had a very bold pinstripe, chalk stripe suit on, and a Thomas Pink bright pink tie. And
Patrick Cox
and I
shoes.
Remember, what's that?
Patrick Cox shoes.
I probably at the time. And I walked in and I remember the guy coming in, and it was for their construction and property division. And they were looking for someone for the construction team. And he was from the UK, and he came in and said, look, you know, really like you, but I don't think you're going to gel with the construction guys. And they were all at the time very Australian, like the chalk and cheese to me. So I got introduced to the lady who was running their office support business. It was lovely, and had a really good chat, and she said, look, is this something that you want to look at? So I started with a business doing office support for the construction sector. So PAs, EAs, receptionists, site admin, project coordinators, anything admin related, but for the construction sector. Did that, really enjoyed it, did pretty well. And then from there, and you know, for the whole of my career, sort of moved around to different areas, all within that construction and property arena.
Did you feel automatically at home within that bigger corporate environment, or was it something that you needed to adapt to?
I definitely needed to adapt. I mean, I was still, again, you know, looking back now, like I was, and again, not necessarily, I was very cocky at a young age. You know, I thought I knew it all. Very, yeah. You know, and I quickly got taken down a peg or two by, and rightly so, you know, by people that had been doing it for, you know, at that time, a lot longer than I, in Sydney, and were very good. And maybe it was just, I was a product of my environment. You know, I'd come from London, you know, very different type of business, very much just bashing the phones, getting stuck in. Where, you know, when I got here, which was not long after the Olympics, so 2002, 2003, you know, there was a lot of work, and it was more about relationships and understanding what, you know, people needed and what projects and pipelining, not just, you know, whilst there was obviously the element of getting through BD and meetings, but I'd never really met people, like, as in I'd never been pushed to go out and meet clients. So even then I had to tailor, you know, my language, my presentation, you know, going on site and meeting a site manager in a Thomas Pink tie doesn't really go down well. So it was just about tweaking, you know, not taking away my ability and my energy and my drive, but just shaping it. And thankfully, I work with some fantastic people who are still in the industry now, who I look back and help, you know, sort of shape that. But to answer your question, yeah, I did, from a point of view that there was a lot of other people that were in a very similar position. So I felt at ease. I enjoyed coming into the office. You know, I liked the environment. It was all like, even just the office, it was, you know, a lot more glitzy than what I'd ever been used to. You know, you had all the right tech. So yeah, no, it was good. As I said, there was it took me probably 6 months to probably find my feet. But yeah, no, I did. I enjoyed it and I felt at ease there.
But how many years were you still rocking the pinstripe suits, or did you eventually abandon them?
No, I've still got one today.
Do you? Good lad.
But it's toned down a lot. yeah, I mean, look, I think like anything, you know, and I know, you know, whether it's and don't get me wrong, I don't wear a shirt and tie suit every day. You know, I'm a realist. You know, I at times mirror my audience, and you know, I don't ever advocate that people have to come into work in a tie. I've just got certain meetings that at times it, you know, that individual, I suppose, is looking for that professional person to come in who they take seriously and, you know, is having a high level conversation. Not that you have to wear a tie for that, but that's just my own feel of how I want to present to someone. But yeah, it was just adapting and just understanding that, you know, you don't, it's not necessarily about, it's not the same as in the UK. You know, there wasn't that bravado as it was at the time in London. You know, it's a different style that you need to adapt to. So, but that was good. Again, you know, I look back on that and think, I'm glad I went through that, because without having that, I don't think, it certainly shaped me as a person as well. You know, yes, I was still confident, but I think I lost that cocky edge to a degree. And I was just a little bit more comfortable in my own skin, which I think I needed to go through that to probably learn that about myself.
At what point in your kind of 13 and a half year Hayes career did you start looking at management as a viable route?
It probably would have been probably about 4 or 5 years in.
Okay.
So I moved, as I said, from office support onto architecture, and then architecture onto rail. And at that stage, I was looking after a couple of consultants. And again, it probably wasn't, I didn't know at the time that I would enjoy management. And I think in terms of at the time, I look back and my manager, who's still a very good friend of mine, probably saw something in me that he felt I had the ability to support other people. And look, I mean, I firsthand admit I was never the biggest biller. I always did okay, but I was never, you know, I was never the top of the leaderboard. Maybe now and again, rarely, but you know, I held my own and I did well. But I was not that top biller mentality. That for whatever reason, that just wasn't me. I enjoyed billing, I still do, but I wasn't that top biller person. But I was very good at building relationships. I was very good at cultivating that, commercializing them. But also, you know, I've been told, and perhaps I feel one of my strengths is that I'm a good listener. I'm very good at reading people. And I had the ability at the time to spot elements of what people were doing that I felt I could assist on without being that person of, you know, that micromanager of just do what I say because I've done it and, you know, I've got all the fees to prove it. That wasn't me. It was more, I understand what you're going through. I've been through it. This is how we work together and assist them to be more successful than they thought they were going to be.
Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? Because our industry is very well known for promoting top billers.
Yeah.
And everybody knows that just because you're a top biller doesn't mean you're going to be a very good manager. You were the opposite. You know, you were promoted because people saw those softer skills. Obviously, your billings were average. But I thought you could redirect your other skills. That's really interesting, isn't it? I haven't really spoken to that many people who were promoted into management because, you know, somebody above them thought or identified that they would be a good manager.
Yeah, I mean, and again, at the time, you know, when my manager said, look, this is something that I think you should, you know, you should look at and consider. I think you'd be good at it. you know, I suppose I felt, you know, I was obviously flattered that I'd be looked at in that way. And one thing I quickly realised, and I still do to this very day, is that I probably get a bigger kick out of helping someone, you know, be successful than I probably do in my own right, on certainly on the desk anyway. Don't get me wrong, I'm very, you know, I'm very cognizant of my own career and how I want to develop and what I want to achieve. But I'm an absolute believer that unless you're, you know, a one-man show, a one-person show, you know, the business is only as good as the people in it, you know, and ultimately what we do, it is all about the people, full stop. So if I can create an environment where I'm getting the best out of people, and they want to come to work, they're motivated, they're working in an environment that is supportive. Yes, of course, you know, there's challenges and there's ups and downs, but I think first and foremost now, and you know, coming up to the present day, I think people just, you know, they want to work for someone that they feel they can have an honest and open, transparent relationship, as I do, you know, and be supported and be heard and work in an environment that is motivating. But also they know their own accountability, they know where they stand, and work together on getting them to a point where, you know, they go beyond the success factors of where they thought they were going to get to. And I suppose, as I said, going back to when I was asked to step into that, I realized that that's something that I really enjoyed. And then it kind of just sort of grew from there.
Were you the person that identified and spotted you as a future manager? Were they proven right? Did you step into that role and you were a natural at it?
I wouldn't necessarily say natural. I think I was natural in terms of that I had the ability to, as I said, to understand where I thought people might be going wrong and what I thought they could do to perform better. And that not wasn't necessarily because I was better than them at that. It was just something that I could see that was or wasn't working. And I could also spot the strengths that people had and the ability to be able to exploit them and use them more and give people the confidence and build their own self-esteem to be able to use them to their advantage. But certainly, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of my management capacity, really from there, that's when it kind of grew from a team of 2 to 5, eventually to 12. And then, you know, to my last role at Hays, where a team sort of notched up to about 50 heads. So, you know, and don't get wrong, that wasn't all me. I was supported. I had a fantastic leadership team as well that you know, I worked with for a very long time, who, again, are all still in the industry and very successful in their own rights. But it was good, you know, and I felt at ease in that role. I felt like I was, you know, a natural at being able to work with people. But of course, along the way, I had to understand, you know, what does work and what doesn't work in management, you know, that it isn't one size fits all. Everyone needs, you know, a certain type of relationship and conversation and motivations. And I think it was just understanding what people needed from me. And probably one of my, and maybe this, you know, now I think about it going back, you know, probably one of my biggest assets is that, and this is sometimes to my detriment, is that I'm the eternal optimist. You know, I will always see the good in anything, and I'll always be the most positive person in the room. I always come to work with a smile and want to do something good. And I always find the small wins to have a sense of achievement when I leave, however small that may be. And I think that's super important that I think a lot of people forget. You know, it's a job, right? We're not, you know, we're not saving lives, you know, and I think some people get so spun out by things because they can't control them or something goes awry. It's life. It's what happens. We're dealing with people. So I think it's just that reminder at times that, you know, don't take things too seriously. Don't take yourself too seriously. Hold yourself to a high standard that you want to hold yourself to and do your best. And then, you know, whatever happens, come back the next day and do the same and just keep testing and prodding and poking. But I think, yeah, it was just probably that energy piece that I was able to bring as well. I think still helps to this day.
Love it. So when you've been out of the Hays machine for quite a few years now, when you look back and you reflect on your time with Hays, what was the greatest learning? What was the greatest takeaway that you took from that business?
I think definitely scaling a business, You know, I certainly don't think I would have been as well equipped coming into a business like Redpath and given the opportunity to grow it if I hadn't have been through that with Hayes. And look, again, you know, Redpath and Hayes are a vastly different business, but, you know, just having a wherewithal in terms of setting people and teams up for success, being able to identify opportunities within the current business, but also within the market. And I think, you know, as most billing managers will agree, I mean, that role is probably the hardest role in recruitment. And I think the time management that I needed to execute extremely well the majority of the time, that's probably what's been the instigator for me to be able to really grow myself. Also in, you know, my private life in terms of managing a busy household and family and all of our, you know, extracurricular stuff. But I think in terms of being able to understand, you know, where I need to attribute my time, why, to whom and how, their skills that, you know, in that business, in that scale, working with, you know, various different entities of the business in all different facets of industry, in different geographies. And then the more senior you get, you know, that you become more operational across a larger piece of the business. You know, that learning was amazing. And to be honest, you know, sorry to jump perhaps to another question, you know, but I think one of the biggest reasons I did stay there for as long as I did was A, because I was afforded great opportunities. And I always felt like that my manager for a long time there really cared about my career. And he kept challenging me, he kept pushing me and kept giving me opportunities to prove and demonstrate that I had the ability to keep moving forward, which was amazing. And maybe I just got lucky working for him. You know, I can only talk for my own my own journey. But also just in terms of working in an operation that scale, you know, they're an amazing business. You know, it was fantastic. I don't look at any of my time there with regret or I should have done this. It was great. I loved it. I've made great friends, like really great friends. They're a great business. I feel like I did a really good job, you know, and hopefully I've helped people develop their careers, you know, and they've then taken some learnings that I learned along the way and embedded that in their own career.
So why did it come to an end? You know, 13 and a half years, you clearly hold the business and your time there in very high regard. You've got great fond memories and you achieved a lot there. Why did it come to an end? Why did you make the move to go from a global organization into a privately owned specialist business?
Good question. Obviously, I've been asked this question a lot and really, really honestly, so I remember coming home from work one day and they said to me, you know, you don't really talk about work anymore. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, you don't really tell me about what's going on at work. You know, you don't tell me about new people you might have hired, people you've promoted, things that, you know, were celebrated. And I said, okay, I didn't really realize. And she said, you know, you always used to love coming home and telling me about your day and, you know, what's happened and, you know, you did this or you met that client or... And I suppose it dawned on me, and if I'm being really honest, and again, this wasn't something I didn't really realize at the time, but I probably was a bit on autopilot, probably the last maybe year to 18 months of my career at Hayes. As I said, I had the foundations of a brilliant business. I think at the time we were one of the lead businesses globally in terms of year-on-year growth. You know, the market was busy. I had a great team of really, you know, really good humans, really nice people, a fantastic leadership team. But I probably wasn't doing myself justice. And in turn, I probably wasn't really pushing the needle in terms of the business, if I'm being really open and honest. And then when Stay said that to me, it sort of just made me evaluate a little bit about, okay, this is, didn't really picked up on that. And then just by chance, it was just as we'd had my second daughter, we were going back to the UK for a month. And that's the longest I'd ever taken off at any one time in my career. And a couple of weeks before I left, one of my friends who was working at Redpath at the time just said, oh, you got a quick coffee before you go. So me being me, thought, oh, okay, things aren't working out, Red Path, he's seeing if there's anything at Hayes. But it was actually the opposite. He said, look, you know, and I knew Nick and Ollie, you know, through the industry, or Nick and Ollie Red Path, that is. And he just said, listen, would you ever consider having a coffee with Nick? You know, they'd be really keen to have a chat about the business and, you know, your background. And in true Hayes fashion, I was like, no, you know, thank you, but I'm flattered. But no, you know, I love my job. Hayes is brilliant, blah, blah, blah. I left it at that. Went on a holiday and I was sitting having, at the time, a beer with my brother, who's done really well for himself in business. And he was like, mate, you're mad. He was like, you're in the recruitment industry and you're turning down the opportunity to meet with a business owner who, by your own words, has built up a great brand in the business, in the industry. Like, what's wrong with you? Why would you not have a coffee with him? What have you got to lose? So he was right. I was like, okay, yeah, you're absolutely, you know, what would I say to a candidate? Like, that's madness. So came back from holiday, reached out to my friend and said, listen, if the opportunity is still there, you know, I'd be keen to have a coffee and let's just see what happens. And then met Nick, you know, a very impressive individual, fantastic background in the industry. And I was just a bit blown away with, you know, probably his level of honesty. And what I mean by that is, whilst what I thought I knew about the Red Path business and the prior business, Judd Farish, that he and his brother, Ollie, built up, which was arguably the largest and global boutique in construction property at the time before it was sold. He was very quick to tell me what they weren't good at, which I really appreciated and kind of got. And it dawned on me that everything that I'd done for the last, you know, 13 odd years in terms of structure and training and development and implementing strategy, and not that they weren't doing that here, but it's just a very different, it was a different business. And in order for them to probably really get to where they want to be and achieve that, it needed someone probably with my background to complement what they were building on. And and then over the course of, I think, about 3 or 4 months, I met with Ollie, met with Nick, met with a couple of other people, did my due diligence, spoke to a few clients. It just felt right. And probably for the first time in a long time, I was really excited. Like, really, I was nervous, really nervous, because I thought, yeah, and this isn't a derogatory comment to Hayes or any of the majors by any means, but, you know, in those businesses, you know, there's, and I don't mean this to sound the way it is, but I'll say it the way it is, there can be some hiding places, let's say that, right? Mm. You can get by with, you know, just doing enough and being friends with the right people and whatnot. And I suppose I thought, okay, if I'm going to take myself out of that environment, am I actually as good as I think I am? You know, can I go into what I saw at the time as a premier brand and mix it up with people that are top of their game, top of the industry? So, you know, I was really nervous. And, you know, but on the flip side to that, I knew that if I didn't do it, I would never do it. And I'd have probably stayed at Hayes and I'd probably still be there now, if I'm honest. And again, whilst people have been there for 20 years and have amazing careers and love it, I just got to a point where I needed something else. I needed to be reinvigorated. And I needed, if, you know, over the years, like most people, you know, I could have started my own thing, thought about it a couple of times. And for whatever reason, family, you know, things just never aligned. And this to me felt like an opportunity to almost do that, but with the support of two very entrepreneurial brothers that have done an amazing job and worked with a team that arguably was, you know, one of the best teams that I've ever seen, and really go up a gear myself and challenge myself and make myself really uncomfortable. And so I signed on and that was that.
So you made that leap of faith. When you arrived at Red Path Partners, what did you struggle with the most to adapt to? You know, because the world that you left and the world that you were coming into was so vastly different. What did you discover to be the major differences that you potentially struggled with a little bit?
The biggest one for me, and again, I've spoken about this before, it was getting away from the mentality of feeling like I've got to sanity check everything I want to do with someone. And it got to a point, and I remember the conversation where I think I was about 6 months in, and I sent an email to Nick about, I can't remember what it was. It was about doing something with a couple of clients. It was probably like a golf day or a lunch. And he came over to my desk and he said, mate, stop asking me. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, stop asking me. Just do it, right? You've been employed for a reason, right?
Yeah.
Look at your job title. If you think it's a good idea, do it. If you want to spend that on something, do it. Don't ask my permission. And it kind of dawned on me that I was like, I keep asking to say, oh, is this all right? Or should I do this? And I think part of it, I was worried about, you know, I was obviously worried about messing up and looking like an idiot or spending money on something and them like, what are you doing? Why are you spending? But it wasn't. It was, you know, listen, you know, you're here for a reason. You know, we absolutely back you and we can see that there's an opportunity here, but just stop second guessing yourself. Mm. Just do it, you know, and if you make a mistake, learn from it and don't do it again. But do it. Have the wherewithal to know that you've got a full support. And that was probably the big thing I had to get my head around. That and also just the difference in the type of person that works for a Redpath to a Hays. And again, nothing derogatory against the Hays businesses of this world. But it was just looking for, you know, probably a more seasoned individual, someone that's you know, a bit more long in the tooth in terms of their experience in recruitment. And, you know, the client base that we, you know, we still deal with us compared to a Hays is very different. And it needs that, you know, at times slightly more, you know, whether it's professionalism or just know-how or you know, relationship building. And a lot of the people I did employ at Hays were new to recruitment, you know, because that was the business model. You know, you employed someone that was from the UK, Ireland, Scotland, maybe an Aussie now and again. You know, you put them through the training program, you know, get them to where they need to be, and then, hey, presto, off they go. Or they'd leave the business and join a Redpath. But it was, yeah, those two things. It was probably just understanding what I can and can't do and stop second-guessing myself and understanding that the different type of person that works for a boutique versus a major.
So now that you've worked in both of those types of environments, and you've, you know, you've got inside knowledge, you've been inside the, you know, four walls of both types of companies, how do you think privately owned organizations genuinely compete with the big boys and improve their own market share and attract their best talent? How do they do it? What's the secret to it? Because I suppose I'll explain where I'm coming from asking that question. My interest in that is that as a rec to rec, I don't do anything with the global businesses.
Yeah, right.
All of my work is exclusively in the privately owned boutiques and specialists.
Out of interest, have you ever done work with any of the majors, or has it always been boutiques?
Look, I have flirted with it a couple of times because in my mind I thought, well, I've got to at least have one of the big boys in my portfolio, and you know, I've briefly, you know, I said briefly, yeah, 10 years ago would have done something with Robert Walters, same with Michael Page. You know, I've had a conversation with Hays, but they've never turned into long-standing relationships I have with the likes of, yeah, Redpath.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you think the secret sauce is? Why do you think those businesses excel?
Yeah, it's funny because I remember when I was at Hays that I used to bang my head against a brick wall when clients would say to me, oh, look, you know, we've gone to a specialist. And my retort was always, but why don't you see my business as a specialist business? All I do is what Judd Farris at the time or Redpath or, you know, that's all we do. We're purely construction and property. And by the way, we've got three times the amount of consultants and the database is three times the size or whatever it was at the time. But I think there was always just the sense and, you know, still to this day that a lot of the bigger groups, they just get tarred with more of a generic brush. You know, they're seen as, you know, a great safe haven for, you know, bulk recruitment, for temp recruitment, for, you know, ongoing work. But when it comes to needing a specific skill set, oh no, I've got to go to a specialist. I've got to go to one of the boutiques.
Mm.
So when I was at Hays, it used to drive me mad. But now having left that and gone into a boutique, I get it. I think the biggest thing is, from a client perspective, they want to have an A to B relationship. They want to have a relationship with the person that they're working with and know that that person is fully ingrained and understands their business, what they need, and work with them in a partnership model, right? And whether that's on a commercial perspective, a process perspective, you know, a brand perspective, and that's the stark difference. You know, we, again, you know, in terms of the pool of consultants we have here, you know, the mainstay of the business is experienced, you know, 5 to 20 odd years experience in an industry, in a chosen industry. So they're well known, their own brands in their own right. And I think, you know, you're what you're paying for there is a network. So, you know, my area of expertise has been client side project management over the past sort of 10 years. You know, so I'm very confident that if someone comes to me with a client side project management mandate, you know, I'll fill it, you know, within reason. I know there's a network there that I can lean on. I've got avenues galore that I can go down. I've got people that know me, that know my brand. I can tap into all different forums. So that's what they're paying for. And that can be done in, you know, 3 or 4 different ways: retained, exclusive, contingent. Whereas a lot of the majors, you can't do that. You can't have that flexibility. They are adapted, don't get me wrong. And I think there's areas where they are, you know, they're absolutely trying to move the needle, which, again, great for them. But they'll never get to the nimbleness and the flexibility that boutiques have, and the way you can operate. And at times, you know, me personally, I was always, when I was at Hays, I refused to come off a desk. And a lot of people at my level were purely operational. They didn't run a desk. But my biggest thing was that how can I sit in front of an audience and be truly relevant if I'm not out in the market meeting with people and filling roles or working on processes? And a lot of people that are, you know, in bigger firms at that level, my own perception was that they weren't client facing anymore. They weren't out and about. They did some nice things, like they'd take a bunch of people to the rugby, but, you know, they'd have a great giggle with them at the rugby, but they'd never speak to them again, you know, or, you know, football or cricket or, you know, an event or whatever. But I was always an advocate that for me to be really potent in what I do, but also then how I train people and how I develop people, I need to be in the market still. I need to be relevant. And I haven't changed my view to this day. So I think it's that, and I think it's the opportunity for clients to, you know, myself, Nick, Ollie, Ben Gregg, who's the other partner on property, you know, we're all client facing all the time. We're always meeting people. And I think that as a brand is extremely powerful in terms of relevancy and connectivity to the market. And unfortunately, you know, majors don't do that. Mainly it's systematic of the size of business. I mean, you know, as I said, a team of 50 and still being on a desk, the amount of arguments I had with my manager at the time about coming off that, but that wasn't me. And, you know, that was never going to be me. So there was always that element of struggle. But I think they're probably the factors what I perceive as being the stark difference.
So, mate, 7 years have flown by. I can remember you arriving. Yeah. At Redpath 7 years ago. So who's this Hayes character? What's going on here? Clearly things are going remarkably well. But what's next? What does the future look like for you? Not necessarily Redpath, but for Jay O'Brien.
Good question. It's funny, it's mad that part of our role is, you know, consistently, you know, thinking about career moves for people and how that would impact a business, how that would impact an individual. But I don't really give too much thought to it myself, mainly because I'm not one of these guys that's just, you know, happy-go-lucky, take each day as it comes. I do like structure, I like planning, I like purpose, but I'm also a realist. You know, whilst I'm an optimist, I'm also a realist that, you know, I can't control what's going to happen in the global economy. I can't control if there's going to be another virus. And I think if anything, it's just about, you know, to coin a phrase, playing what's in front of you, right? And just turning up and doing your best and having a bit of fun, you know, not taking yourself too seriously, working with good people and enjoying what you do, but just do it to a high standard.
Yeah.
So, you know, since I've been here, you know, got Melbourne off the ground, which is a great success. We've got a team of circa 10 people down there now. really great business, fantastic culture. Got Adelaide off the ground, a phenomenal business. Just made our fifth hire down there in under 2 years. Going extremely well. New Zealand opened up this week, which is fantastic. So I'm over there next week with the leader of the business there. And we've also just opened Singapore. So in terms of growth, it's been fantastic. And again, everything that Nick and Ollie gave me the reins to do and the assistance and support has come to fruition or starting to. But I think for me, it's, you know, as without sounding a bit flippant, I still love what I do. And I know, again, oh, you're going to say that, but I do. I still love what I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it for 20 odd years.
Mm.
I really enjoy the industry. I love meeting people. I love talking. I like working with people that have got ambition and drive. And I still remember going back to the prime days in London, that buzz. Like, I love it when we're in the office and it's busy and things are going on and there's a bit of banter and there's, you know, it's just great. I love it. I just get immersed in it. And when you see people who are, you know, late 20s or early 30s and all of a sudden they've started to, you know, buy a blooming property in Bondi, it's like, that's amazing. Like, that is amazing. And it's things like that where I get such a kick out of and just developing, you know, people's career and helping them. And in turn, obviously, then that, you know, that develops my own career, you know, and it consistently challenges me and, you know, looking at different angles and working with different people and different groups. But I enjoy what I do. You know, as I said, I think, you know, physical and mental health, I think, is so important, you know, for getting the best out of me and people around me. But yeah, I think, again, it's always good to look back and take stock on what you've done. I'm not one of these people that I don't really like the spotlight. I know I'm doing this, but I don't really like the spotlight. I don't like, you know, oh, this is, you know, I just like to, I like everyone to enjoy it. I like everyone to enjoy what we do because we are a collective. We're a team. But I think, you know, moving forward, I want, absolutely, there's more growth. You know, Queensland is well and truly on the radar. You know, I know Nick would say no, but maybe even Perth. You know, and then like London, again, you know, expanding the UK market. There's absolutely opportunities there. The US, we've just hired a few more people there. We've just got a few new hires in Hong Kong that are going to focus on China. You know, Dubai is going absolutely gangbusters. So would we have a business based in Saudi at some point? Maybe. I mean, most of our work is there. So, you know, it's working with leaders that have got an ambition to keep growing and being part of that. But here, right here, right now, it's about enjoying what I do and coming to work and working with the best people I can find and helping them develop and become more successful than, as I said, they thought they were going to be.
In closing, before we move on to the kind of final advice section of the podcast, when you go home now at the end of the day, do you tell Stace about what's going on at Redpath Partners?
I certainly do, to the point where she's actually born.
Tell you to shut up.
But I do. Like, you know, again, I think, you know, whether it's marriage, friendship, mum, dad, brother, sister, like, communication is, and obviously in our job, is absolutely key. And, you know, I'm not saying we're perfect by any means, but, you know, whether it's over the dinner table or, you know, a cup of tea or you know, just, you know, relaxing, you know, talking about what we're doing, careers, what's working at work, what's not working, what's challenging, you know, I think is really important. And again, you know, I now, you know, she can see that element of enthusiasm again, where in terms of, oh, this happened, or we're doing this, or I met this person, or, you know, we nailed this today and it's brilliant, or God, this day was horrendous, you know, this happened, this didn't go my way.
Mate, will you go home tonight and tell her you did a podcast?
You know, it's going to be the topic of conversation around the dinner table. I absolutely will.
Mate, thank you so much. The passion comes through loud and proud. Now, mate, I've added a little section onto the podcast. Going back to the concept, which is to educate, motivate, and inspire. I've chosen the profiles of four hypothetical recruiters at different stages of their career. I'd like you to give them advice. I'd like to think you're probably qualified to answer all of them. The first one is a rookie. What advice would you give a trainee starting their first recruitment job next week?
Oh, good question. I think it's hopefully their manager has painted a picture of, you know, that it's not all cupcakes and rainbows. You know, there is an element that they're going to go through ups and downs and challenges. But I would say, look, just don't take things too seriously and don't worry about what you haven't done. Right. My advice that I would give them or someone that's, you know, 20 years into their career is the same. It's leave the office with a sense of achievement every day. Right. And however small that might be, whether that's just getting through to someone on a call that you've tried, you know, or it's making, you know, your biggest fee in your career, it's the sense of achievement that will bring you back the next day. And I think that's really important. And whether it's you're talking to your partner or you just walk out the door with, you know, your chest out knowing that you've done something good today, I think that's really important from as I said, from keep progressing your career and day to day, week to week, month to month, but also just from a mental perspective, knowing that you've done something good. I think that's really important. And yeah, there's going to be setbacks. Things won't go your way. As I said, you're dealing with people. Stuff happens. But, you know, letting things get personal or taking things too seriously, that's when the cracks start to appear and you start overthinking things. You start second guessing. So just let things unfold organically, but just stick to what you know works. Stick to a formula, a matrix, a plan, and execute it to the best of your ability and just take the small wins day by day.
One of the most heartbreaking things for me, mate, is when I see recruiters with about 18 months, 2 years recruitment experience leave the industry because they just haven't found their groove. Things haven't clicked. And as you know, there's a variety of reasons as to why that might be. What advice would you give to somebody 2 years in who's thinking about chucking the towel in?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm the same. You know, I've worked with some people that I think, you know, had the hallmarks of doing something really good. Things get a bit rocky and they throw the towel in. Look, again, and maybe it's, as I said at the start of this podcast, you know, my training was either non-existent and or horrendous, right? But one thing it did teach me is grit. And sometimes you just need to dig in. You just need to get your head down and keep going. And yes, there is an element of when things might look a bit bleak or, you know, like when we went through COVID, like I had no idea what was going to happen. I had no idea what I was doing really, right? So the only thing I did, what I knew, was keep talking. So I was calling people every day. I was speaking to clients. I was speaking to talk, just keep going and going and going and going. And then, hey, presto, when things changed, all of that work I'd done started then come to fruition because people remembered that I was on the phone to them constantly, whether it's the staff here or clients and candidates. So it's no different. Just dig in, show a bit of grit, get through it. And that will only make you a better recruiter. And the reasons you got in it and enjoyed it for the first 12 months will come back in the year 3, 4 and beyond. But chucking the towel in now, you'll never really know what you could have achieved unless you get through it. And things are hard. Jobs are hard. Life's hard. But just keep going. Give it a bit of a crack, and just as I said, just back yourself.
Just deviating very, very quickly on the subject of COVID, and speaking to people since you arrived on the scene, Jay. I don't speak to Nick Redpath super regularly because most of my dealings are with you. During COVID, Nick called me, and for no other reason. Just to see how I was doing.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of calls like that, but, you know, but they were probably from people I speak to with regularity. And I remember putting the phone down being, reasonably touched by the gesture. So if Nick happens to listen to this podcast, which he might not, he's a big, thank you, Nick. I appreciated that. I went off on a tangent there. Mate, what advice would you give somebody looking to step into the first management role? You are very qualified to answer this question.
Yeah, I think, look, first and foremost, just make sure that it's definitely something you want to do, because the first thing that any manager realizes is time and the lack of it that you dedicate to your own desk. So you need to be really sure that it's something that you want to attribute an amount of time to, because any person you're managing, that's what they need from you. They need time. So I think if you're going to do it, you've got to go into it wholeheartedly. And I think, as we said earlier, unfortunately, yes, there is a bit of a sense of, oh, if someone's billing well, chuck them into management. They must be a great manager. Unfortunately, it's normally the opposite, because the reason they're doing well is because they've got that, you know, selfish, and I don't mean this in a bad term, but they're just tunnel vision. You know, they think about what's in front of them, and they're motivated by filling roles and placing candidates, right? Mm. They're not concerned with spending, you know, a half day planning with someone to get their quarter up and running, or go on 6 or 7 meetings with them that week to make sure someone gets their pitch right, or that they're presenting right. It's just not the right DNA. So I think, A, make sure you know what that you know what the role is and you're in for that. Mm. And then B, make sure that you're able to structure your time accordingly. And one thing that I found out really quickly, and still, you know, I have challenges with it to this day. I'm a big believer in planning. So every night before I leave and every week before I leave, I always have a plan for the next day or the next week. And I think one thing that gives me is the opportunity to allocate time to what I need to do, whether it's an individual, a process I'm running myself, something on the business, an event, whatever it might be. Mm. But I think without that, it's too easy to let the day come to you, and it's too easy to be dictated by your inbox or your phone. So I think planning for any manager is absolutely key. And also, I think, you know, you don't need to be the all singing, all dancing manager straight away, right? I wasn't one of these people, because, as I said, whilst I wasn't the top biller, I was a decent biller, but I had other hallmarks of, you know, in terms of setting my desk up, structuring, business planning. But I think, you know, use what you're good at. So if you're good on the phone, right? If you're good at winning business and you're good at being out there, then do that and just let someone come along for the ride, because then they'll learn their traits and they'll learn their own way of then using those elements in their own way and their own pitch. But if you try to be the jack of all trades and, right, you're going to be super structured, you're going to be brilliant on the phone, you're going to be, it won't work, because you're not being true to who you are. So in what I was told in my first management gig for my then boss, just exploit what you're good at. You know, you're good at being energetic, you're good at, you know, helping people, working with people, listening, talking. Do that and you'll be fine. And I think it's just understanding what you're good at and using that as a manager.
Brilliant. Last question. Now, you haven't technically done this, but you do work with a recruitment entrepreneur, and I'm sure as a 20-year industry veteran, you mentioned actually earlier that you've thought on a couple of occasions about doing your own thing. But what advice would you give to somebody thinking about going out and striking out on their own?
Look, I always tip my hat to anyone who's got the minerals to go and give it a go. And as I said, you know, it's something, Matt, perhaps I should have done, or I could have done, for whatever reason, just didn't happen for me. But I think, look, if you've got the wherewithal and you've got the drive and dedication to do it, then you should give it a go. I mean, you know, the worst thing that happens, put it this way, anyone that's probably good enough to run their own business, if it doesn't work, you'll get another job. Hmm. Right. So again, you know, it's always, don't ever live with a regret of, I should have tried it, I should have done that, I should have, you know, should have gone for it. But I think just know who you are and what your angle is. Because one thing I do see is there's a lot of people that go out on their own, and it's very generic. It's very, I'm going to be this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to cover as much as I can. And I just don't think that has, you know, I don't think that has any potency in the market. You know, if you're good in a firm because you're known for something, then stay doing that. But do it on a scale where the clients that you're working with know that you're going to partner with those groups and that you want to be working with those groups. But I think, you know, there's too many people that just become this, you know, slight sort of more generic, and then they dilute their own brand. So I think if you're going to do it, but know what, who you are, and what your entry point is into that market. And then I think beyond that, I think if you, depending on what you're doing it for, some people do it for lifestyle. Some people really want to grow a business and scale it. But again, I think knowing what you want to be and what you want to do, because, you know, at times there's other people that, and, you know, friends of mine who've got their own business, you know, and they, it might be more of a lifestyle choice, but they still want to grow a business. Mm. But my point is, well, how do you do that? Because anyone that you're going to employ needs you. They're joining for you, really, if you're a, you know, a circa 5 to 10 person business. So if you're not there 2 days a week, you're off playing golf or with your family or whatever, then they're either going to do it themselves, or they're going to lose the essence of what they can get from you. Mm. So you need to choose. Is it, I'm doing this because I want to work 3 days a week and still have a nice lifestyle? Great, do that, and more power to you. But if you don't, and you want to scale something, then make sure you've got the right business plan behind it, and make sure you've put the level of effort and thought process into the milestones of how you're going to get there. But you need to be involved. You need to be there. It's going to be all encompassing. And I think there's still a few people that haven't worked out. They're probably in the middle. They like to grow for obvious reasons, but then they still want to work 3 days a week. And I, again, if I'm wrong, fine. I don't think you can do that. You need to be one or the other. So I think it's just about knowing who you are, what you are, and what you want to be.
Love it. Mate, there we go. That's your first podcast done.
Amazing.
Did you enjoy that?
I did, yeah, no, it was great. I mean,
bit of self-reflection.
Yeah, it's good. I think it's, I'm not one, as I said, to do this, and not that I don't want to or anything. I mean, as I said, I'm flattered that you asked me, and thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it. But I think it's good to share information, and I will, I promise, listen to some of your other podcasts. if anyone listens to this, and if there's one person that goes, oh, that's a good idea or whatever, Amazing.
Love it. And I'm so glad that I've given you something to talk about back at the O'Brien household this evening.
you will do. Stace will be happy.
Thank you, Jay.
No worries.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes another episode of Recruitment Journeys. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, it would be awesome and really appreciated if you could like, share, or subscribe, or ideally all three. Again, we don't ask for much at Recruitment Journeys, just a little bit of love. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time for the next episode of Recruitment Journeys.